This program is brought to you from the Margaret Farrow Studio.
Hello and welcome to Newsmakers. I'm your host, Lisa Pugh. You wouldn't know it by watching the news, but there is more than a state Supreme Court race on the ballot this April 4th. Wisconsinites will be asked several questions, including two that could change the state constitution. There is also a race in the 8th Senate District, which will determine if the GOP moves closer to a supermajority in the state Senate. Many other local races on the ballot also across the state. And we are joined today by two election experts who are going to break it down for us. Henrik Schatzinger, professor of political science at Ripon College, also the interim director at the Center for Politics and the People at Ripon College. And then we also have Dustin Brown, who is with UW Law School and a staff attorney with the State Democracy Research Initiative. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
There's so much to talk about. So first question, is this the best time of year for people who study democracy and politics?
I would say so. I mean, what other time do we have to really look at politics in action just like we have right now? So I love being in the classroom. I actually teach a class on campaigns and elections, and this is the perfect time to talk about elections.
Favorite time of year, Dustin?
Well, I appreciate the fact that you recognize how important this time of year being April is to democracy, because oftentimes people don't realize how important April is to democracy because people are focused on the elections in November. Mm-hmm. But there's been a lot of attention for good reason on the election that's happening on April 4th.
You know, recently in Wisconsin, it seems like all of our elections, people say they're historic, they're record-breaking. Can we say that about this election?
Yes, we can. I study money in politics, and one of the things we can look at is just campaign spending. And I think later in our conversation, we'll come back to record-breaking amounts of money going into these elections.
Is this a historic spring election, Dustin?
Oh, absolutely. And in terms of breaking records, there is also record-breaking turnout in the primary preceding this April election for the Wisconsin Supreme Court. So there are many kinds of records that are already being broken.
So let's talk about that big race on the ballot, the one that we know we're seeing all over the news, state Supreme Court. The race will show up at the top of everyone's ballot, regardless of where they live. And if you haven't heard, voters will be deciding between conservative Justice Dan Kelly and liberal Judge Janet Protasiewicz. What's the main thing voters should know before they go to the polls about this race?
I would say the main thing for me would be to know that the stakes are really high in this case. I mean, if we look at the level of polarization in this country and also in the state, and if we look at the split power that we have at the state level, chances are that some important issues are going to end up in the courts. And so at the same time, incumbency is strong, and whoever gets elected will be there for at least 10 years, and chances are that person may be there for a couple of decades. And so from all of those things combined, I think that this election really matters.
The biggest issue we know that the court will take up, regardless if there is an ideological shift on the court, is the issue of abortion. How does what happens in the election impact what may or may not happen with the abortion issue?
Well, The election is going to determine the ideological balance of the court. Right now, there are four conservative justices on the court and three justices who are seen as liberal. The justice whose retirement is creating this vacancy, Justice Rogensack, she's considered conservative. So it's going to be kind of a 3-3 split. And then whichever direction it's going to go is going to be determined by this race. And although the race, you know, is formally nonpartisan, it's been described as nonpartisan in name only, because, you know, each of the candidates, Judge Protasiewicz and Dan Kelly, who had been a Wisconsin Supreme Court justice, you know, each of them is backed by different sides.
We are seeing that on the news, for sure.
Absolutely. And so with respect to the abortion question, there is currently a lawsuit that will decide whether or not the 1849 abortion ban is actually, you know, continues to be in effect in Wisconsin. And depending on which candidate ends up winning the race, there's a good probability that that could affect how the Wisconsin Supreme Court would rule on that question when it finally comes up to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Right now, it's in Dane County Circuit Court, but eventually it is inevitable, as you were saying before, that it would come before the Supreme Court, no matter how, no matter what the outcome of this race is.
How long until we would see a change on that?
How long until the Wisconsin Supreme Court would hear that? It's really difficult to say. Right now, the case, it's still in, you know, what we describe as the pleading phase, where there is a motion to dismiss the complaint that's pending. And, you know, it's unclear when exactly that will be resolved. But if the case is ultimately dismissed outright, then an appeal would be initiated. If it's not dismissed, then, you know, the parties continue and they actually litigate the questions at issue.
A lot of money and influence in this race. What are you seeing in terms of who's trying to influence the outcome?
Yeah, some things are really interesting about this race when it comes to money and politics. First of all, we're seeing record-breaking amounts of money that are being spent, over $30 million in this race. In fact, the exact number right now would be $32.5 million. But what's interesting here is that about 40% of those of this money is being raised and spent by the candidates, and about 60% by outside groups.
Is that unusual?
Not anymore. Not anymore, because I wrote a book about this, two and a half years ago, and I point out that this is actually nowadays fairly common. But many people don't realize that, and so what I would point out is that both candidates have a very different breakdown between those, between how they spent the money. So if we look at Protasiewicz, she is raising about $12 million on her own, and she does get some support from outside groups, but not anywhere close to Kelly. So Kelly has two groups that support him primarily, and that adds up to about $12 million. He himself has only raised about $500,000. So he is heavily depending on outside groups. Some of those are actually being funded from out-of-state donors. The GOP mega donor, Richard Uihlein, is the largest individual donor that supports him in this race.
Dustin, if Judge Protasiewicz wins and the leaning cements more of a left-leaning, liberal-leaning majority in the court, what are some other cases that we might expect to come before the court in short order?
The one big case that we could anticipate coming before the court would concern redistricting. So as I'm sure everybody is aware, the congressional district boundaries and the legislative district boundaries in Wisconsin are heavily gerrymandered, giving a strong advantage to Republicans in those races. And that gerrymander, that dates back to 2011 when we had a Republican governor and the Republicans controlled both houses of the legislature. So for the first time in decades, they were actually able to pass a set of maps through legislation because there wasn't a conflict between the executive and the legislature. So they ended up adopting these very gerrymandered maps. And then, you know, a decade later, 2020, the census comes around, and the legislature is obligated to revisit those districts because now we have new population figures, and we need to ensure population equality in each of these districts. But by that point, we had a Democrat who was the governor. So the legislature wasn't able to get its maps through, and so the Wisconsin Supreme Court stepped into that void. But the outcome that we saw at that point, it was not actually fair maps because the Wisconsin Supreme Court, to start the process, said we're going to adopt a least changes approach. So we're taking as our starting point those earlier gerrymandered maps And we're going to ask the parties to this case to simply, you know, make whatever adjustments are necessary to comply with the law.
So would we get new maps, and then how quickly would that happen?
Well, so we got new maps as part of that process, but they're still very gerrymandered. So now the question is, would the Supreme Court revisit that question? And if the court shifts to a, you know, more of a liberal majority, I think we strongly anticipate that some parties would bring a new lawsuit, now bringing a challenge to these new maps, which the court just adopted, whereas the litigation from just the last year was challenging the maps from 2011 because the population was out of balance.
Would the court take action prior to, say, a November 2024 presidential election?
I think we can definitely anticipate that. I would expect that a lawsuit would be filed, you know, again, if the composition of the court changes, you know, pretty much as soon as that happens, as soon as the composition of the court changes. And in these cases, they're challenging cases. They're very fact-intensive, but they can be done quickly, and courts are accustomed to doing that. So I think we can expect that the question would be resolved in time for new maps to be in place for the November 2024 election.
Do you anticipate if Justice Kelly wins, we can just expect more of the same in terms of the court action?
Yeah, that's a great question. And both candidates have been asked at forums about this specifically, and neither of them have said, you know, how they would vote in this case, because they need to see, of course, the details of those cases. However, and Protasevich has said very interesting things about this. Let me just quote. Let's be clear here. The maps are rigged. Absolutely, positively rigged. They do not reflect the people in the state. So it's pretty clear where she stands and that she is sort of willing to revisit this issue.
Other cases that you would anticipate if the court shifts?
It's difficult to predict what cases could come before the court, but there are some buckets of the kinds of cases that we would expect to see. Cases about elections, both challenges to election outcomes and election procedures. That's the kind of case that I wouldn't be surprised if we would see, along the lines of, you know, what we saw in 2020, where there was a case that the Wisconsin Supreme Court heard brought by Donald Trump, challenging the votes in Dane County and in Milwaukee County. There are also cases concerning procedures for elections. For example, the court in its last term decided a case concerning drop boxes and decided that drop boxes can't be used for absentee ballots, and also that individuals have to return their own absentee ballots when they're returning them. So those are, you know, past cases. But then coming ahead, there will be more elections. There will be more challenges to elections. And there are already percolating in the circuit courts lawsuits challenging certain procedures related to elections. You know, one that's currently happening concerns the certification that a witness needs to sign for absentee ballots. And there's a question as to how complete does their address need to be, which is one of the things they have to fill out on that certification. If some details are missing from that address, does the ballot have to be thrown out, or what actually is sufficient? A case like that could very well end up in front of the Wisconsin Supreme Court.
Major election theme in the Supreme Court.
Absolutely.
Okay, going forward. Let's move on. Constitutional questions receiving considerably less attention on the ballot. Are these two questions that have passed would change the state constitution as it relates to how bail, cash bail, is applied to those who've been accused of the crime? Let's look at that question here. Question one, there's actually two questions. Question one says, shall the Constitution be amended to allow a court to impose on an accused person being released before conviction conditions that are designed to protect the community from serious harm? Question two says, shall the Constitution be amended to allow a court to impose cash bail on a person accused of a violent crime based on the totality of the circumstances, including the accused's previous convictions for a violent crime, the probability that the accused will fail to appear, the need to protect the community from serious harm, and prevent witness intimidation and potential affirmative defenses.
This is where you take a breath, because that was
right. That is a lot. Yes. I'm going to spend a lot of time reading that question. So why is this on the ballot?
So just to kind of, you know, take a step back and understand what's going on, because voters, you know, people are already voting with early voting, and they found that these questions are confusing, and the questions deal with two separate but related matters. They relate to the conditions of pretrial release for criminal defendants. The first question refers to non-monetary conditions of release. So things like monitoring, supervision, other restrictions imposed on, you know, a criminal defendant, again, who's released before trial. So this is somebody who's presumed innocent. Then the second question refers specifically to monetary conditions of release, which
that
is bail.
Cash
bail. Exactly. And if we can pull up, I don't know if you can see it yet, but if we can pull up the red line, because one thing that the questions don't flag is how exactly is the Constitution being changed? So for this first question, it's actually like a fairly simple change. One of the conditions that, one of the factors that a judge can consider when setting these non-monetary conditions for release is protecting members of the community from serious bodily harm. The change in the first question simply cuts the word bodily. So now it becomes, you know, protecting members of the community from serious harm.
Which is a lower standard.
Right, exactly. So more types of harm could be considered and be part of the mix. And it also says that what it adds there is as defined by the legislature by law. So this is saying
Which they just passed a bill.
Well, yes. So it hasn't yet been, you know, signed by the governor, so it's still in the process. But there is a proposal that would define what serious harm is. But suffice to say, it's more than bodily harm. It can involve financial harm, psychological harm, that sort of thing. So again, that expands, you know, what the court can see, what a judge considered there. The second question, I think, is the one that's a bigger deal, and that concerns cash bail. And right now, the Constitution only allows the judge to consider, when setting cash bail, the likelihood that a person is going to appear for future appearances.
Are they a flight risk?
Exactly. Are they a flight risk? And so this just adds a lot more factors, and it says a judge can consider the totality of the circumstances, including protecting the community from serious harm, prior convictions for violent crime, and preventing intimidation of witnesses. And this is for defendants who are accused, again, just accused at this point, of violent crimes. And violent crime is something, again, that the legislature still needs to define. So in terms of arguments for and against this, the argument for this, you know, simply says, look, you know, a judge needs to consider whether somebody's a danger to the community and factor that into the determination of bail. So obviously you set a higher bail for somebody who could pose a danger to people. Those who oppose this say, yes, completely agree, we need to consider the dangers posed to the community, but bail's not the answer. Because that just, you know, ties this to a question of how much somebody can bail. That's not what's on the ballot. So if somebody disagrees with using cash bail as kind of this, you know, indicator of, you know, whether or not somebody is going to be released, they would want to vote no to this, and then that could, you know, perhaps prompt the legislature to develop another more risk-based approach that doesn't tie someone's release to bail and how much they could pay, but rather, you know, simply says if you're a risk to the community and we've made that determination, then you won't be released.
What a complicated question. Do you think that this will pass, and do you think that's going to drive people to come out to the polls, that question?
Yeah, I think Dustin did a great job breaking down the legal aspects of it. I can speak a little bit to the political aspect of it, because these kinds of questions are not unusually be put on a ballot to motivate some people to come out. Because ultimately, when you look at these questions, you can say, oh, okay, there is a signal to voters that we want to be tougher on crime. Now, if you want to be tougher on crime, it can motivate some of the base, especially among Republicans, to say, "Out, you know, I want to make a statement. I am for these kinds of, you know, new guidelines, especially also giving the advisory a referendum which really has no real practical direct implications because we already have work requirements.
Let's talk about
in
that.
Place.
This the third question. So after people on their ballot will see those two bail reform questions, they see this third question called a non-binding advisory referendum. Mm-hmm. Deals with programs used by low-income individuals called welfare programs. On the question, we're seeing that on the screen. It says, "Shall able-bodied childless adults be required to look for work in order to receive taxpayer-funded welfare benefits?" Why is that question on the ballot?
Well, I would say, again, because it really signals to voters, to some voters, that we want to make sure that we don't have these free riders. So we want people to don't just receive benefits for free, right? And so having said that, we already have those kinds of work requirements in place for people who receive food share or SNAP benefits, and so it does not really change a whole lot directly. I think, in my opinion, it is much more of a signal to voters that we hear you, that we see you, and that we understand what you want from us.
What is a non-binding advisory referendum?
It's basically a poll. It's like putting a poll on the ballot. You know, that's the legislature has the ability to put these questions on the ballot, but you know, as the name indicates, it's simply advisory. It's not binding, and in this particular case, it's advising the legislature on something that is in fact already codified in law. So
will
so
it have no impact?
I don't think this would have any impact.
And do you think it'll impact turnout? Do you think people will come out because this question's on the ballot?
Well, I think that is the motivation among Republicans to say, let's put this on the ballot. Now, is it really going to move the needle? I think for many citizens, they're not even really aware that this mm-hmm. is on the ballot, and the focus is so much on other parts of the race that I don't see it really being a game changer for any party.
So let's move to Senate District 8. So that's a race on the ballot for people who live in southeast Wisconsin. That's a district that includes northeastern Milwaukee County, southern Ozaukee County, southern Washington County, and northeastern Waukesha County. The candidates there are Republican Assembly Representative Dan Knodel and newcomer Democratic candidate Jody Habish-Sinikin. Why is this race important?
It is important, but because we are looking at a potential Republican supermajority in the state legislature, which then, if a Republican were to win this race, Knodel, then it would allow them to superride, vetoes in the legislature. So the veto issue is one thing, and it could also mean that the impeachment and removement of state officials, including the governor, could be something that we could see in the future.
Yeah.
And sorry, just to chime in, actually, I think, so as impeachment goes, yes, absolutely, because the impeachment power is something that's in the state Senate.
Having a supermajority in the Assembly.
Exactly, without having a supermajority in the Assembly. But the Senate needs a two-thirds supermajority to convict if there is an impeachment because the Senate conducts the impeachment trial. For purposes of the legislative veto, there is not currently a supermajority in the Assembly. It's close. Mm-hmm. I think the Republicans are two votes shy of a supermajority there.
Both chambers have to have that supermajority.
Exactly. Both chambers would need the supermajority. So it definitely moves the needle closer to the possibility of there being a supermajority in the full legislature. But even if the Republican wins this race, it would only create a supermajority in the Senate. So the legislative veto, so overriding the governor's veto still would not be a possibility
even
after this.
Power could be significant.
It could, and it's untested. I know that Dan Knodel has in interviews spoken about the possibility of exercising that power, but only in Wisconsin's history, there's only been one impeachment, and that was, in the very early years of the state, in the 1850s,
right?
I can't say I would be surprised if there was an impeachment. I think the point is that there's very little legal authority telling us what the impeachment power is, how you would actually conduct it. You know, there's even kind of questions, because if you look at the constitutional language, it says the assembly shall have the power of impeaching all civil officers of this state for corrupt conduct in office or for crimes and misdemeanors. So how would you define, like, who are the civil officers of this state? There's some ambiguity there. You know, what would corrupt conduct in office be, or crimes and misdemeanors? So those are some questions where there could certainly be room for debate. So there could be motivation to move forward with an impeachment of who knows, but there would be legal questions surrounding it.
So a question for you, Henrik. This is thought to be a Republican district. Tim Michaels, I think, beat Tony Evers with 52% of the vote. Ron Johnson in November got 54% of the vote. Do you think a Democrat can win in Senate District 8?
Yeah, it's a very interesting district, because after the last redistricting process, Republicans thought that they actually made the district more Republican, which they did initially for the first 5 years. And then the demographics shift a little bit in that district. So part of that district is northern Milwaukee, the suburbs of Milwaukee, and they have become more Democratic. So more Democrats voters are moving into that part of that district, and that has made it more competitive. So especially given that this is an April election, the answer is it could happen that Democrats for the first time might win this district in a very long time. So is it likely? I would say not very likely. Is it possible? It is possible, since, you know, we said the stakes are high in this election. Here's another example of that.
I know you're also watching some local races. What are the most interesting local races on the ballot, do you think?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, I'm really passionate about the role of money in politics and the role of outside money. For my next book, I'm working on some of the major cities in America, you know, in the U.S., like New York and Los Angeles. What we have seen in those cities is that some of the real estate associations are pouring lots of money into city council and mayoral elections to influence, you know, development projects. For the first time, we're seeing this now also in Madison. So we have seen a real estate association putting up about $20,000 for 10 different city council races, and then also the mayoral race in Fitchburg. So this is one, these are races to watch.
You expect that to continue, that sort of money and influence?
Yeah.
Local level?
Absolutely. So we have seen that already in the last few years, especially in Green Bay, which is also a race to watch in this election.
The mayoral race.
And there are several reasons why this race is so interesting. Part of why this race is so interesting is because we have a very divided city council. So if we have a 6-6 split, we see more and more often that the mayor actually breaks those tie-breaking vote. Exactly. So plus there were some other lawsuits and all kinds of drama in Green Bay. So it is definitely a race to watch. And if I can mention one more race to watch, which is also interesting, is the Racine mayoral race. What we see is also lots of outside money coming into the state. Some of the money coming from Illinois, and even though the incumbent is raising a lot more money, it's just noteworthy how much attention that race is getting from all kinds of sides.
Interesting. What do you think about turnout for this election?
I think we can expect significantly higher turnout than we would typically see in an April election, and I'll be interested in seeing just how high it goes. I mean, one indicator that there will be higher turnout is the fact that in the February primary there was, in fact, record-breaking turnout in the primary, which reduced the field for the Wisconsin Supreme Court election from 4 down to 2. So we'll see what the turnout is, and, you know, how close it comes to the kind of turnout we see in November, which historically is much higher than what we see in April.
And turnout could make a difference in a lot of these races?
Absolutely. This is very much a turnout election, I would say. And if we just look at the February elections, we saw that Democratic candidates, aligned candidates, outpoll GOP candidates by about 8 percentage points. So there was a lot of dynamism among Democratic voters, especially sort of in Dane County, which is a huge deal for Democrats. So if that continues, that should be probably a really a good night for Democrats. But again, with those questions on the ballot, constitutional questions, the advisory questions, and many other things, it's really an exciting election. So I hope everybody goes out and vote.
Which race will you be watching most closely on April 4th?
The Wisconsin Supreme Court election.
The same.
The same. Okay. Well, a reminder to voters, the election is April 4th. Polls open 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. You can find your polling place information and get a preview of what's on your ballot by going to myvote.wi.gov. And thank you to both of our guests for breaking down the ballot. Really appreciate the conversation.
Yeah. Thanks again for having us.
Yeah, thank you for your interest.
And thank you to the viewers of Newsmakers. Be sure to tune in again as we highlight the issues and sit down with the decision makers who make a difference for all of us.
This program was brought to you from the Margaret Farrell Studio.
This program is a production of Wisconsin Eye, an independent, nonpartisan, nonprofit media network with a mission to inform, educate, and engage the citizens of Wisconsin. Wisconsin Eye is the nation's first and only independently funded state civics broadcast network, providing gavel-to-gavel access to government proceedings and events at the state capitol.